Great. A very good evening. Thank you for joining. Our topic is kashrus, which is an enormously complex topic. And that's exactly what our theme hopefully will be. Very often people approach kashrus with the concept that it's no big deal. I'm a Shomer Shabbos. I know basically milk, meat, basically what could go wrong? And that's really what we're looking to address, to appreciate that in today's modern world, even forgetting about whatever you have to know in the past, but in today's modern world, there's a lot of education, training, knowledge, experience that goes in to running a good kosher kitchen, whether you're in the role of mashgiach or just an educated consumer to understand what's going on. By way of illustration, I know of a certain person who's very big Talmud Chacham, who was giving a certification on a certain company, and he felt that he was dealing with a very simple hashgacha. They had non-kosher stuff that they produced there, so he told them that they just have to run a clean cycle in between, and then they can make the kosher. And his reasoning was that he asked them, are there any fires on site? And they told him, no. Nothing is done with fire. And he figured, well, if nothing's done with fire, it's cold, simple, just a clean process, and we're good to go for kosher. Well, Vayihi Hayom, a different hashgacha came in to see if they could certify as well. And they did their own inspection, thankfully. And they walked through, and they saw that the kettles in which the product was being made had steam jackets around the kettle. Now, if you're familiar with company-type production, a steam jacket is used. It's a double-type kettle where the inside kettle is indeed holding your product, but there's a glove, if you will, covering over the kettle into which steam from some unknown boiler source is being piped in, and it keeps the kettle just at the right temperature that they want because of the steam jacket. They definitely were using heat. They just weren't using fires on site. And they definitely had to kasher hot properly after a non-kosher production. And they weren't doing it because this very big Talmud Chacham, with all due respect, never reached his hand to touch the kettles and find out that they're hot and then ask, well, if there are no fires, how does it get hot? And they would have certainly explained. No one was trying to dupe him. He just didn't know what questions to ask. Another example. Hashgacha on lollipops. So companies don't like to hold on to molds of lollipops because it takes up a lot of space. So they have this ingenious idea that they use cornstarch and they have one set of molds that makes the imprint in the cornstarch and then makes the imprint in the next cornstarch. And like this, they just have to have one metal sheet of mold creators and all the cornstarch gets pressed the way they need it. They pour in the lollipop syrup and they have lollipops in cornstarch molds. What happens to the cornstarch when you're done with your non-kosher lollipops?
Use it again.
Oh, well, one mashgiach asked, and they said, well, it goes out into the bin. It goes out until a more educated person did a review of the company and said, it goes out to the bin where it's refined, and the same product is sent right back in. They're not bringing in bales of cornstarch for your kosher lollipops, fresh cornstarch, unless you contractually bind them to do that. A lot of kashrus has nothing to do with the sefer. It has to do with knowing the industry. We had this week a Star K trained representative do us a courtesy and review some of our locations with a new set of eyes, which is something that's commonly done in the kashrus industry. You have somebody else look at your work, and very often you reciprocate, but whatever it is. He walked through one of the kosher milchik places in town, and he took a look at the kosher Chalav Yisrael cheese that the gentleman was using. And he said to him, do you know that there's a different Chalav Yisrael cheese on the market that's sold in bulk at a considerable discount than what you're paying for this cheese wrapped the way it is in individual wrappings? And you can buy it bulk from a different vendor and you'll save yourself 25%. The reaction of the proprietor is, I like that, Rabbi. Because he knows his stuff. It's not just about the kashrus, it's about bonding with proprietors, bonding with the workers, so that if something's up, they're going to tell us about it. Obviously, when we talk about a shul kitchen, it could sometimes be much more tame. We certainly hope so. But an awareness of how hashgacha works, and that a lot of it has to do with information. Aware that there's no way you can get that product produced without heat. You tell me where the heat source is. What I'd like to do is explore different areas of kashrus topics by way really of seminar education style with anecdotal evidence as needed, with the idea that an educated person is the best commodity we have in the field of kashrus, whether you're a consumer or you're working as a mashkiach or whatever the role is. I'm convinced that if a person has the basic education and is aware of the issues, then we can go ahead and train such a person in hashgacha in about a half hour. Because once you understand the issues, it's just a question of what the policy is going to be. Our first topic that I wanted to cover is a tshuva from Rav Moshe regarding bugs and vegetables. Once a person understands what the issues are or aren't, you can walk into any situation in your kitchen or in a shul kitchen or in a factory commissary, and you know the issues. So it's just a question, okay, what vegetable are we dealing with today? And what is the normal method of washing, cleaning, checking such a vegetable? That information is imparted in about 5 minutes if you know what the issues are on the fundamental level. We have a tshuva from Reb Moshe, and tonight I'm kind of locked into Reb Moshe Feinstein. Not sure why, but that's the way it turned out. Reb Moshe was the transition gadol for the United States in terms of creating a Masora and standards in the United States. Reb Moshe was the go-to address. This particular tshuva from 1959, regarding a question of bugs, presumably in coleslaw or some other type of leafy vegetable. Reb Moshe writes, "Bedavar factory." Does anyone know what a factory is? Okay. Sha'osa salat. Does anybody know what salat is? Okay, so far we're okay. Mimine yirakos, from different vegetables. V'yesham gam min kruv. There's also some sort of cabbage. Shekorin kraut. We're okay? Okay. Someone complained that it's in Hebrew. I'm not sure if it's in Hebrew or not. Im yesh lachush litola'im. Do you have to worry that there are bugs in the kraut? Kevin Shabala factory hu nachri o Yehudi Mechalel Shabbos. The owner of the factory that's producing this, let's call it sauerkraut for argument's sake, is not Jewish, or is a Jew who violate Shabbos publicly, and we can't rely on him. So if you want to use the product, what do we need to do? Ein lo ne'emanas al kashrus. He's not reliable. He tells us, he calls us on the phone, "Rabbi, it's all good." Fine, it's all good. But I'll be making an inspection. This concept that you have to forbid vegetables from eating them until they've been checked, that only applies if it's a product that normally has bugs. How do we define normally? So there are three categories. If an item is 50% of the product will have a bug, that means that if you took two portions of lettuce and one of them will have at least one bug, so that's something that's called muhzak bitola'im. That means that basically this product has to be washed properly and or checked. If it's less than 50%, all the way down to 10%, that means that if you had 10 portions, or some say 10 heads, there are different ways different kashrus organizations will define this, but for argument's sake, 10 portions will have at least one bug. That's called miut hamatzul. It's minimal, but it's still common. And that also has to be washed, checked, whatever the method is going to be. 1 in 10. If it's less than 10%, then we get into a discussion among poskim. Is the 10% used by the Mishkanos Yaakov merely an expression? And he meant something that doesn't really happen too often. Or did the 10% said by the Mishkanos Yaakov mean literally 10%, and if it's less than 10%, it's nothing? But if you would reach a point that it is not common to find bugs here, then it does not need to be checked. An example is pistachio nuts. There are people who have found bugs in pistachio nuts. And if you like to eat pistachio nuts while you read a book and not look at them as you're reading, reading, if you could do them simultaneously, which I can't seem to say them simultaneously. But no problem. Because they're not muhzak. Just because someone found, I remember when Bodek first came out, so someone says, I found a fly in the package. Okay, so where does that leave us? It's not muhzak betolayim. I found a fly on a chocolate cake once. That doesn't make it anything. That doesn't change anything status. It means, is there a likelihood that the product in front of me will have bugs, even in a small frequency? But it's likely among the portions that I have, then it would have to be checked.
So you mentioned the 50% level and then 10% level. Practically speaking, once you get above 10%, does it make any difference?
There are going to be differences in the policy, the way it's going to be handled. We do handle romaine lettuce differently than we handle iceberg. They both have to be washed. They both have to be periodically checked and make sure your washing process works. But I'm sure there's a difference. Based on the frequency, based on the intensity, you're going to know. I'm told that the good hashgachas, when they get a shipment of broccoli, for example, the mashgiach goes to the loading dock, takes off a sample, runs back to his workstation, smushes it into a basin, checks it quickly. If it's infested, he tells them they can keep their broccoli. You're not going to take a case and then not be able to do anything with it. Because if it's so infested, then you're going to wash. After three washes, many kashrus agencies say you have to throw it out. It's not going anywhere. If you're still getting after three washes. Now, it's not a... We'll have to discuss rules, and it depends on each vegetable. But I'm trying to get fundamentals, what to look for. If it's infested, you're dealing with a different product than an item that's just miyot hamotzi. Keep in mind, by the way, and we'll get back to this later, a bug is defined as something that we can see with the human eye normally. The only reason that we get involved with magnification is because it's easier on the eye, number one. The mashgichim can move faster if it's magnified. He doesn't have to squint. He doesn't have to look. But more importantly, you're looking at a dot. That's visible. But I don't know what the dot is. So if it's a bug, it's forbidden because it was available to be seen by the human eye. But I don't know if it's a bug. So you could use magnification to verify if it's a bug. And that's what we're talking about. I mean, this is common. You could have pieces of dirt when we check romaine lettuce, typically before the Seder. So you see these specks. You don't know what they are. Most of us simply wash them off because what's the difference? If it's dirt or it's a bug, just get it out of here. But if you're looking to be educated as to what a bug is or isn't, you could have a loop available. You flip it on right above the thing. You look at it. And if you see those very pretty legs, then you know that you're dealing with a bug. And it's important to just know what you're dealing with. So Rav Moshe was asked, we have this cabbage that's being produced by a non-Jewish company. Are we allowed to eat it? Says Rav Moshe, min kraut, the same product, b'medinosenu sheb'Europe. Does anybody know the word Europe? Okay. In our countries that we were familiar with, Hayamin Hamatsi Botoloyim, it was a product that commonly had bugs. Faya also Bilibidika, and it was forbidden to be eaten without checking it properly. He writes, there were many people who didn't even eat it after it was checked because they were afraid that people don't know how to check well. Okay. Aval b'medina zu America. But over here in the United States, b'min kraut la matzah klal toloi, we don't find bugs. Maybe he was talking about red cabbage, whatever. He was talking about whatever type. Or in his time, 1959, when he'll say in a moment, they're using pesticides heavily. V'imkein, eina me'aminim sh'asurim b'lo b'dika b'kan. There's no reason to worry about bugs, because it doesn't have bugs. And I find that this statement from Reb Moshe, if your thinking cap is on, is a phenomenal statement. Because so many people want that the kashrus agencies should just give us a list. Just give me a list. What do I have to do about which vegetable and which fruit, and I'll be done. Now, they could give us a list, but the list lasts for a season until things change. And that's why the big kashrus agencies have a number of people who are dedicated to staying up in the field and constantly checking the product. Rabbi Shalom Tendler in the Star K flies across the country and checks the fields before they're harvested. Reb Moshe writes, as he continues, V'lochein, and therefore, it's possible that you're supposed to be checking everything, because the reason it doesn't have bugs is not because the product doesn't have bugs, but because they're using insecticides. So Reb Moshe wonders, how does the chazaka here work? How does the assumption work? On the one hand, the product as it's hitting me doesn't seem to have bugs, but I know it's only because they acted upon it with an unbalanced force called insecticide. What happens if they didn't do the insecticide, or they didn't do it diligently enough, or something like that? Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, by the way, used to peel his tomatoes because he was so disgusted with the amount of insecticides used on everything. He was like the only person. I'm not sure if peeling your tomatoes really protects you or not. But what happens, if Moshe says, if they don't do the insecticides properly? So who's guaranteeing that? So he wonders that maybe it should still be checked. I find this fascinating because Reb Shalom Tendler, when he checked fields across the United States, he says that he found that there could be an entire section that's totally bug-free, and then suddenly he finds it infested. And can't figure out why. It's the same field. It's owned by the same owner. And he asked the worker, and the worker says, look up. He looks up, and there are telephone wires going across the field at that point. The helicopter or airplane that's dropping the insecticide cannot do a good job near the telephone wires because they can't fly there. And therefore, you can have a field that's pretty good, except for the section that he cordons off and say, I don't want from there. Likewise, he points out that the few rows near the street or near a train are going to get a lot of junk being blown into the field. And where there's junk, it's less sanitary, and you end up with a bigger mess, and you end up with more bugs. Are we dealing with halacha here, or are we dealing with logistics? Person has to know his field in order to be effective. Now, the star K in particular, and I just, we happen to be developing a relationship with the star K now, so I'm naturally just quoting a lot from their material. They have an interesting tip that comes up in a product bug-related concern, flour. So really, flour doesn't need hashgacha. Flour is a straightforward product, unless it's I don't know what you do with it, but it's considered a group one. It's considered a normal product that doesn't need special hashgacha. But occasionally, either in flour or in matzah meal, people find that if they store the product for a period of time, suddenly there are bugs in it. And they don't know where these bugs came from. And especially if there's a good kashrut certification on the front of the product, don't the bugs know that they're not supposed to be here? So it once happened in matzah meal, and a reputable kashrus agency was asked, how in the world could you give hashgacha on matzah meal? And then suddenly we open it and we find bugs. And what emerged was that the kashrus agency gave the hashgacha because at the time, to the best of our knowledge, human knowledge, it was 100% kosher. But what was in there, I hope everybody ate their supper already, were microscopic eggs. Now, if you have microscopic eggs, as long as they're microscopic and they're not visible, if the FDA don't have trouble with it, we don't have trouble with it either. It's not considered a barrier. It's not considered an item as far as halacha goes because it's microscopic. But if you leave microscopic eggs at the right temperature to incubate for long enough, it's going to produce bugs. And the assumption is that when the product was originally sold, it was indeed kosher. But if it's sat long enough in opportune conditions, especially if it made it to the supermarket supply and then made it, because it didn't get sold, to the dollar store, and it's still sitting around, and you look at the expiration date, and you say, well, it's only a few months ago, you are running a risk of purchasing a product that may have developed a problem after the certification was given. A interesting suggestion is made regarding flour or other similar products. If you freeze the product for 4 days, it eliminates the possibility of these microscopic eggs developing. So I know I've heard people say, yeah, I store my flour in the freezer. I mean, if you wanted, you could, and it certainly protects it better. But if a person doesn't have that kind of room in the freezer, the concept that's being talked about is simply putting it in the freezer for 4 days and then pulling it out and storing it in plastic bins, in airtight plastic bins, so that you dealt with the microscopic issue possibility, and then it's in a cool, dry place and you shouldn't have a problem with it. Moving on to another example of nuance in kashrus, eggs. So we all know how diligent we are. I mean, this is the sign of a kosher kitchen. After the separation of milk and meat, I mean, that you check your eggs is where it's at. In the times of the blood libels, they actually used the checking of eggs as one of the best ways to respond to the foolishness of a blood libel. They used to bring a woman from the market, the Jewish woman from the market who was buying eggs, bring her straight into court, and if the judge had any doubt that we put blood in our food, they would just ask the woman, crack an egg and do what you normally do. And she cracks the egg and she starts checking for blood spot. And what would you do if there was a blood spot?
Throw it away.
I would throw it out. Why? We're not allowed to eat blood. I mean, this is basic. Where does that leave us, la halacha, in our time? In other words, what's the concern and what's the halacha? So, it's interesting. I heard from the OU years ago that in large commercial settings, restaurants, they allow a non-Jew to crack the eggs and check. The mashgiach checks over him, but they allow him to check it. But the way that they feel that they have control, that the mashgiach's oversight is sufficient, is that they offer the non-Jew $1 for every blood spot or worse. Any contaminated egg, so to speak, halachically, kosher-wise, they offer him $1. And they say that the method works because the excitement for the worker, yeah, he comes running to the mashgiach whenever he finds something. But what's that about? What's the concern? Why are we throwing away the egg? So, we're all familiar that the two types of eggs you could be dealing with. You have natural, where the egg could be fertilized, and that's the type that's discussed primarily in halacha, that if there is a blood spot in a critical location, then it indicates that you're dealing with a developing chick in its very earliest stages, and that's the expertise of knowing where the blood spot would be at the joint of the yellow and the white. And then you're dealing with eggs that were laid that have nothing to do with fertilization, and if there's a drop of blood in there, how did it get there? It got there from the mother as it developed the egg. It has absolutely nothing to do with the possibility of a fertilized egg. If you're dealing with a fertilized egg, then indeed it has to be thrown out. If you're dealing with a drop of blood from a different source, then you discard that drop of blood, and that's it. Rav Moshe writes, Hinei b'davar ha-beitzim, regarding eggs, Nodati, I'm familiar, Shem Kisafna Mayara, that there's no fertilization in your typical egg here in the United States the way they're producing them. She'enik lotos laholid efrochim, it's not developed like that. That's not the way our industry is. It's true at one point they were even candling the eggs to make sure, but basically the way it's done now, it's unlikely. Really, there's no prohibition on the egg itself. You just have to throw out the blood itself. But just yesterday, I came across a farmer. Yes, we're familiar with the Hebrew word farmer. Sheosik bebeitzim, who deals with eggs. V'omarlin, he told me, sheyesh farmers she'oskim b'tarvayu, there are farmers that do both. It's actually in right now to have naturally raised eggs. So he writes, v'ata yeshmakom lahatis tam beitzim, the typical eggs, v'medina hazos medin rov, it's the vast majority. And you can rely on that if you found a blood spot. Yaski bezrika sadam, ikar hadin, if you're pushed against the wall, strict halacha, you just have to discard the blood spot. Avalamaisa, he says in the next paragraph, but the bottom line, the way it's practiced, Kevin de Bebeitza lo nechshav l'ruba d'ruba ha'anashim hepsed klal. Most people don't consider the loss of one egg to be a significant loss. I don't know, since then the price of eggs has doubled. But be that as it may, it's still, I mean, that's, you know, in the greater scope of things. We find in halacha that they were very strict. If it's just one egg, that they were very strict. Lachain, therefore, even though it's just a small minority that would come from the possibility of fertilize, common practice is to discard the entire egg. Af she'ein zemidino. That's common practice. But that's not really the strict halacha. And therefore, if a person already accidentally, improperly mixed it in with other eggs, what's the halacha? Unless you know that it's from naturally raised, you assume it's from the majority, and all you have to do is take out the blood spot itself, that you notice it when you notice it, and you're not going to start saying, well, the egg is forbidden, and it mixed with the others, which is part of the batter, and now I have to dump the whole thing. That's not true. Another example of how important it is to know the basic background. Okay. On to the topic of Mashkiach. So, there are a lot of items out there that people think do not need Hashgacha. And what we find is that while they may or may not need true absolute Hashgacha, but there are specific things that we're looking for and we want to make sure are attended to. An example. Canned vegetables. What could go wrong with a canned string bean? Corn. What could go wrong? The answer is that on the product itself, if it's domestically grown, meaning out of Eretz Yisrael, because Eretz Yisrael has its own laws and needs certification. But if you had vegetables from the United States, nice, simple case. The way items are canned is that they are put into water in a process called a retort, and they're put into this water, and they're heated up to sterilize it, to cook it, whatever they're looking to do with that product. That water is in need of tracing, because if they did Franks and beans in the same water, then even though there's metal in between, but that metal is the equivalent of a pot, and the pot became treif, and you put a treif of pot with product into my vegetable water, and now you want to put my vegetables to cook in the same water, that doesn't work. Now, does that mean you need mashkiach tamidi? You need someone there the whole time to make sure that they don't do anything with my water? Presumably not, as long as they sign a contract that says what products they're going to use this machinery for, and you come in periodically and check on them and see that they're being straight about it, you're fine. But for that reason, particularly vegetables, we will not buy unless it has a certification on it. It's up to the certifying agency to decide what level of certification they're going to require. I mean, the OU, for example, gives plenty of hashgachas on bottled water. And we really can't complain because it generates good money for good causes, but they're the first to acknowledge that bottled water doesn't need certification, just like Tide detergent doesn't need certification. But if the company feels they're going to up sales by getting certification, then we're willing to sell it to them, but they require an inspection. oh, you, from my understanding, will never go less than once a year on an inspection. One time, they found bottled water was being boiled in the same vats as other products. I think it was beer. So, you know, they felt at least justified that they're collecting a hashgacha fee for it. But whatever it is, they will not certify on less than once a year, because that's what we're looking for. We're looking for, to see that everything that was described is indeed being done. Canned fruit is a little bit of a debate. I've heard from at least two hashgachas. They say they don't know why, but they've never encountered a fruit cannery using the retort for a non-kosher product. I heard from a different gentleman today that he thought such a leniency was crazy, because something coming from China, for example, there's no way you could verify anything like that unless it's certified. So maybe it still depends whether it's domestically produced. If it's in a bag, frozen vegetables, it's fairly lenient. As long as it's not a bug type vegetable or fruit, but in the bag setting, frozen, we don't seem to have problems. The only problem that we encounter is Pesach time, that they do pasta on the same machinery. And for Pesach, you don't want to buy something like that without certification. But during the year, it's considered unusual to have a problem, and frozen vegetables are fine. What are we looking for in a mashgiach? So let's turn over to the second side. The question that Rav Moshe was dealing with was a person in town who everybody was convinced was really honest, but he was not observant. He was not an observant person. Didn't keep Shabbos publicly. Rav Moshe writes, you'll see I underlined the third line, even if a person is honest, usually, and you seem to get the indications that he was straight with you, if a situation arises that he doesn't need to tell you the truth, because he knows he can get away with it, because at this point there's no way you would know, right? In Chinese food industry, the Chinese restaurants, one of the biggest things that we look for is that the owner, typically a non-Jewish gentleman, shouldn't be bringing in two bags of chicken cutlets every day from a different source in his private briefcase, and then just slitting the seals, slipping it into the supply, and saving himself, if you do it every day, a considerable amount of money. At least in his mind, he's saving a lot of money. Even if the person talked straight when he thought you could catch him, what is he going to do if he's convinced that you won't catch him? And the only way to accomplish that is if you're dealing with someone who personally is observant and he's committed to these same standards. If you look in the second paragraph, second line, Rav Moshe writes, Harbe pa'amim, many times, I mean, you think you know this person, he'd never lie. People change over time based on outside influences and because of different desires, such as to make some extra money. Unless you're dealing with a basic observant Jew that we consider him righteous and that he would stand up even if the temptation was there, he would stand up to it. And that's really what we're looking for, basics in a mashgiach. But obviously, it goes a step further, because the mashgiach is supposed to be watching what's going on, and they have to have the backbone, if you will, not just to stand up to their own Yetzer Hara, but to be able to stand up to whoever else they need to stand up to and tell them, you can't do that way. Usually, we construct things both in restaurants, companies, and shul kitchens. We construct it in such a way that the worst we're going to get, hopefully, is a policy violation. You know, we don't do that over here. Not that anybody's bringing in treif of meat. But we're dealing with a policy violation. You know, we don't put milchuk pat on the fleish counter. If you did it, you could call the rabbi, and he'll probably figure out a way that it's still kosher, but it is a policy violation, because sometimes it can mess us up, and even if it doesn't, that's the minig that we're very makbid to keep. We have different tablecloths, and we have different pot holders, and we have different. We keep them separate. Hopefully, all you're dealing with is a policy violation, but sometimes it can be worse, and either way, a person has to be prepared to stand up to it. Finally, in terms of Reb Moshe Tshuvas, I give you one about Chol of Yisrael. I think it's very illuminating to understand the general concept of different kashrus agencies having different standards. You know, there's supposed to be one halacha. How could you have a machlekes? Either Moshe was told in Sinai that you have to do it, or he was like, what? I don't understand. And this is as classic as it gets, because Rav Moshe goes ahead and actually says that you could do it. I'll explain in a second. It's kosher, but I wouldn't do it. He writes about Chol of Yisrael. Ubedavar hacholov shel ha companies. Does anybody know what the word companies means? Okay. Bemedina seinu. It means industrial standard reputable companies. Asher yesh pikuach hamemshala. That the government is watching. The way Rabbi Wein described it to us in yeshiva, and he was the kashrus head in the OU for a number of years, he said, if USDA inspector comes in and finds the slightest irregularity in the milk, they will dump the entire day's production down the drain. So the fear with Chol of Yisrael, the fear why you require Chol of Yisrael in Europe, outside the United States, it's required, is because we're worried that the farmers figured out chemically, if you add in a little bit of non-kosher milk, whether it's pig milk or whatever it is, they figured out that it stays longer, it stays fresher longer. And not just the general, you know, like maybe they mixed in something into my food. There was a very distinct advantage to mixing in non-kosher milk. And therefore, outside the United States, that was always the halacha. You had to have what we call Chol of Yisrael, was a normal halacha. But in the United States, Reb Moshe says, the government is so careful about this, you can't have such an irregularity in the milk. It has to be natural cow's milk. Otherwise, they'll lose the whole day's production. Im yarvu, if they'll mix in Chol of Behema Temeya, non-kosher milk, Yeyonshu, they'll get a fine, v'gam yaskiru esa esek shalahem, and they'll also close down the business, which is a pretty good reason not to do it. V'lochein, on the third line, arotza lismach u'lohakel, a person who wants to be lenient, yesh lo tam gadol v'rashai. They certainly can be lenient and rely on the fact that if it's marketed as natural cow's milk, that's what it is. And you could rely on that. The OU, for example, goes straight away and relies on that. That's OUD, is what we call Chalav Stam. Avon Mikol Makom, Reb Moshe writes, Leba'alei Nefesh, for people who are a little bit more careful, Min Haroi LaHachmir, it's proper to be Makbid on Chalav Yisrael. Ve'em Besem Mishum Yuara, there's nothing extravagant halachically that you're going overboard. And personally, I'm careful. But if a person wants to, it's halachically acceptable. And that's why we have this fascinating thing. The OU, for example, will give hashgacha on what we call chalav stam. Star K will absolutely not. The Star K created a different hashgacha called the Star D, I believe it's called, in order to give such hashgachas in conjunction with National Council of Young Israel. OU gives the hashgachas, but for the record, my understanding is that the vast majority of the rabbinic coordinators observe Chol of Yisrael. So how do you do that? The answer is, why not? Read the tshuva. Rav Moshe says it clearly. It's acceptable, but it's not something that everyone's going to rely on. I give it simply as a tame and innocent example of how you could have different kashrus agencies approaching the same exact shaila and coming out with two totally different approaches, and each one will be very careful. Star K treats non-chal of Yisrael, keep it away, they'll kasher before they move in to produce something that they'll certify as chal of Yisrael, because that's how they're approaching it. The OU likewise is very big into their certification integrity, and if they certify it as chal of Yisrael, they will require kashering beforehand, which is really the oddest thing, but they base it on product integrity. If we're going to say it's Chalav Yisrael, it's going to be Chalav Yisrael to the nth degree. And again, nothing with Chalav Yisrael, but just like any time we watch the certifications, whatever their policies are, they're supposed to be carrying them throughout. In terms of homework, you're not going to be tested on what we did so far, because I'm sure you know it. If you want to spend time, though, the certifications that I give you are CRC's quick reference guide, and these are what they consider the most common hashgachas to be on the market. They consider them either reasonably acceptable or 100% acceptable. It depends who you ask. But basically, these hashgachas are in the ballpark. They also have a more extensive list, which is equally acceptable, just not as commonly on the market. Our capital K is in the more extensive list, basically because we're not big into exporting products to other communities. It's really created to service our community. Both lists are on the CRC website, which is crcweb.org. Also, if you want to do additional research, Star K created a website called kosherclasses.org, as well as their own main star-k.org website. And at kosherclasses.org, they have mini classes on all kinds of different topics. And you could basically just click the one that you're curious about, and it's a phenomenal way of building your knowledge base in all areas of kashrus. I thank you very much for joining. Have a wonderful evening.
Yeah, thank you.